From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Boys Don't Cry, we talk with Kimberly Pierce, the director and co-writer of the film, and Hilary Swank, who's nominated for an Oscar for her portrayal of Tina Brandon. The movie is based on the true story of a young woman who wanted to be a man. While hoping to have a sex change operation in the future, she cut her hair, changed her clothes, bound her breasts, and passed as a man. But when Brandon's two male buddies found out that he was a she, they raped her and later murdered her. Also, rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the New Orleans rock and roll band Huey Smith and the Clowns. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House has voted in favor of a resolution urging lawmakers to get to work on compromise gun control legislation. The measure called for a House-Senate committee to hold a public meeting on gun control legislation within 2 weeks. President Clinton also urged Congress to get to work on the issue, and he accused the National Rifle Association of threatening lawmakers who voted for today's resolution. The NRA and its supporters in Congress say new gun control legislation isn't needed. They say the administration is trying to draw attention from its own failure to enforce existing gun laws. Palestinians and Israelis have agreed on the next handover of occupied land, 2 months after it was supposed to have been transferred. If the deal is approved by the cabinet, Israel will withdraw from another 6.1% of the West Bank next week. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Jerusalem.
The land includes areas near the cities of Ramallah, Hebron, and Bethlehem. It does not include Arab neighborhoods near Jerusalem, the issue that blocked peace talks for nearly a month. Palestinians first walked out when Israel refused to withdraw from Jerusalem suburbs. This week, Israel offered a neighborhood slightly further out, but right-wing groups again protested, and Prime Minister Ehud Barak scuttled the plan yesterday. Right-wing politicians complain Barak is giving Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat more power in deciding which land he gets. Left-wing newspapers point out Israel's supposed to make peace with the Palestinians, not Israeli hardliners. Palestinians will renew their demand for control of parts of Jerusalem when peace talks resume Monday in Washington. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Crews are cleaning up the wreckage from an early morning train derailment in northeast Kansas. No one was killed, but more than 24 people were hurt when the train went off the track near Carbondale. Jay Schaefer reports from member station KANU.
A total of 16 cars jumped the tracks in the pre-dawn darkness, landing in a rain-soaked Kansas cornfield. Seven of the cars flipped onto their sides. Even before emergency crews could arrive, passengers were busy trying to pull others from the wreckage. Red Cross volunteer Alice Caracas says a couple from New York traveling with two small children was especially heroic.
They were riding in a sleeper, and when the train derailed and went over on its side, they were on the high side, and the mother was able to open the door and help a lot of people out. Neither of the babies were hurt, and the husband, who was on the upper berth, flew across, but he wasn't hurt.
The Southwest chief was on its way from Chicago to Los Angeles. Investigators are now trying to figure out what caused the train to derail. For NPR News, I'm Jay Schaefer in Lawrence, Kansas.
The Dow gained 320 points today to close at 10,131. The Nasdaq lost 124 points. This is NPR News. Officials in southern Louisiana now say a tornado left 30 people injured when it tore through the town of Houma this afternoon. The tornado ripped the roof off a discount store, damaged homes, and knocked out power. A local hospital says at least one of the injured was in serious condition. The ongoing strike by Boeing engineers and technical workers is locking up jet-making operations and deliveries. The Wall Street Journal says Boeing will now halt research on a new line of commercial jets. Ruby DeLuna reports from member station KUOW in Seattle.
Boeing is reassigning some of its employees who normally work in product development to fill the gap left by the 15,000 striking engineers and technical workers. The walkout is in its fifth week with no resolution in sight. A Boeing spokesperson denies a published report that it has mothballed its research program indefinitely, but it has stopped temporarily. Some managers say the company's decision to halt the program would hurt Boeing's long-term ability to compete against its rival, Airbus Industry of Europe. Boeing employees report another change as a result of the strike. The company is bringing engineers from its St. Louis and Long Beach operations and is using more outside contract workers. For NPR News, I'm Ruby DeLuna in Seattle.
The Federal Trade Commission has agreed to suspend a lawsuit aimed at blocking the proposed $30 billion merger of BP Amoco and Atlantic Richfield. One government worry was that the united companies would have too much control over oil production in Alaska. Atlantic Richfield, also known as ARCO, offered a compromise by agreeing to sell all of its holdings in Alaska. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hilary Swank is nominated for a Best Actress Oscar for her performance in the movie Boys Don't Cry. My guests are Swank and Kimberly Pierce, who conceived the film, co-wrote it, and directed it. The movie is based on the true story of Tina Brandon, who in 1993, at the age of 21, decided she wanted a sex change operation. In the interim, she would try to pass as a man. She changed her clothes, cut her hair, bound her breasts, and took on the new identity of Brandon Tina. Brandon moved from his hometown of Lincoln, Nebraska, to the small town of Falls City, where he was taken in by a group that he befriended. He fell in love with one of the women, and they had an intimate relationship in which Brandon managed to keep his real gender a secret. But he was outed as a woman after he was arrested for a minor crime. When his two new male buddies found out that Brandon was really a woman, they raped her and later murdered her. Here's Hilary Swank as Brandon Tina in an early scene from Boys Don't Cry, after Brandon has started to pass as a man. Brandon is staying at his cousin's trailer.
What is the matter with you?
Oh, no! I don't know what went wrong.
You are not a boy. That is what went wrong. You are not a boy.
Tell them that. They say I'm the best boyfriend they ever had.
Do you want your mother to lock you up again? Is that it? Is that what you want?
No.
Then why don't you just admit that you're a dyke?
Because I'm not a dyke.
Kimberly Pierce was a graduate film student at Columbia University when she read about the murder of Tina Brandon. I asked her what she related to in the story.
Well, I related to, first of all, Brandon. You know, front and center, he was everything to me. I really loved this character. The enormity of his imaginative leap, his humor. You know, he was a bit like a scoundrel. So all that I fell in love with. And then the story more at large, what was so interesting to me was the intensity by which she recreated herself and then the amount to which other people fell in love with her, that people were looking for a person like Brandon, that Brandon managed to create a place in their lives for himself. He recreated a family. And then that once this family structure was working, as his secret leaked out, they felt the need to destroy him. So it really was like such a dramatic premise that resonated with so many things in my life, that I wanted to get to know Brandon and get to know the guys and get to know Lana and the love affair and make sense of the tragedy.
What did it resonate with in your life?
Probably the fact that I left home at an early age. You know, I left at 17, went off to University of Chicago. You know, when that didn't work out because my scholarship was put on hold, I went off to Japan and lived for a couple years. And I feel like my life has always been driven by desire and a sense of reinventing myself and recreating families.
What about gender? Did you ever have gender issues yourself?
Well, I think we all have gender issues. But, you know, yeah, sure, definitely. As a little girl, I used to, I was part of this thing called the Tomboy Club. And my friends and I would build forts. And right at the edge of dawn, we would go out to the golf course. And there was a whole bunch of us. And we'd see the ranger at a distance. And we would say, "Ranger." And we'd all run different directions. And we'd get chased down. And we'd come home. And our parents would be like, "Act like girls." And we were all like, look at each other like, "Oh, my God, what are they telling us to do?" It's like the most confusing moment in our life. So we'd be forced to go to school with dresses on, and you know, everybody would be in a half state of rebellion. And I don't think I ever really figured out what it was to be a girl, but I definitely figured out what it meant to be myself. And I think that that was kind of the guide for my life, kind of a practice of, like, individuation. And, you know, gender's taken on all kinds of complicated things for me. What that meant that I would dress up as a boy sometimes with my friends, but never pass because I look totally like a girl, or, you know, think of myself as a director like a guy, like John, you know, Huston or John Ford or any of that stuff. So I think gender's very prevalent in my life, but I think it's very much so in everybody else's, too.
Now, I understand that Boys Don't Cry started as a short film that you were making for your thesis at Columbia Film School, Columbia University Film School. And then it just the story just kind of got deeper and bigger and ended up into a full feature film. And you looked for an actress to play the part of Brandon-Tina for, what, about 3 years? And you've been quoted as saying that you auditioned every lesbian and every transgendered actor that you could find, and no one quite made it for what you were looking for. What were they lacking that you knew you needed?
Well, what they had was they could pass in real life, and this was a lived experience, which was great, kind of like a stock character. What they didn't have is something that few people in the world ever have, which is an extraordinary gift to exteriorize your emotions and to play a character not only on a stage but on a screen. So it's not so much that, you know, I guess I don't want to put them in a negative light because they were wonderful, but what a gifted screen actor has is, you know, look at the population. It's one in millions upon millions upon millions. So they couldn't exteriorize the emotion. They couldn't turn it into a character. And therefore, if they couldn't turn it into a character, even though they really were living the part up on screen, it wasn't something that would pull you into the performance. And that was everything. There was no way to tell the story if you didn't have an actor.
But before we meet Hilary Swank, the actress who you chose for the part, I'm interested in hearing how you, what her audition looked like to you and what you saw in her that made you realize this is it.
Sure. So you're right to say it took 3 years, and I had looked at every butch lesbian and transsexual in the country. You know, there were these walls up in the society because back in 96, the actors wouldn't come out for the role. There was a big stigma attached to it. Then Ellen came out, and there was kind of a proliferation of gay images. And like maybe in 98, I got flooded with girls. So all these actresses were coming in wanting to be Brandon, but none of them had any idea what it was to be a butch. So 4 weeks before shooting, you know, I go to Christine and I say, look.
This is Christine Vachon, the producer.
Christine Vachon, the producer, I said to her, we need a girl who can pass as much as Brandon. We need an unknown. And if we don't find Brandon, we don't have a movie. So we sent our casting agent out to L.A., and, you know, late one night, this tape came back. And on that tape was this absolutely beautiful, androgynous person, unlike any other that we'd ever seen. He floated across screen. He was cocky. He had a cowboy hat on. He had a sock in his pants, and he smiled. So unlike any of the people before him, he not only blurred the gender line, but by smiling, he completely invited you into this character, and he could act. So that was the beginning. And then Hilary, we didn't have any money, so she flew herself out to the audition, passed as a boy to the guard downstairs. That was a good sign. Made it into the audition, and I made sure to have 7 people in the room because I knew that this was more than just my judgment, because I know lots of, you know, transsexuals and butch lesbians, and I totally think of them as he if they identify as he. I wanted this person to work cinematically for the mainstream. And, you know, for people in general. So when she blew us away as Brandon, then we knew we had something. And then that really was the beginning of the journey for Hilary and I because, you know, even after that, I said to her, where are you from? And she said, I'm from Lincoln. And I said, how old are you? And she said, I'm 21. And I was like, my God, it's like the second coming because that was all the Brandon statistics, you know, and then sent her away and she came back and I found out that she had lied. And I said, you know, I know that, you know, you're from Lincoln, but you're not 21, you're 24. She's like, yeah, well, Brandon lied.
And so, that's right.
And so I said, and don't you ever lie again. But, you know, she probably lied all over the place. But that was the beginning, and then we took her down, and, you know, I said, I'll give you this role under the condition that you make a full transformation like Robert De Niro in Raging Bull, and she was down for it. And I think it was a bigger transition than either one of us imagined, and the next step was, you know, we went down to Astor Place, and, you know, where the B-boys get the haircut, and, you know, just set to it. And I really didn't think she was going to pass. We were cutting the hair, and by the end of it, so we had to fire one woman who, you know, in the middle of cutting her hair, was like, no, she's too beautiful, I can't do it. And then we had another woman, and by the end of it, you know, Hilary was like this cross between Matt Damon and Leonardo DiCaprio.
Well, let me introduce Hilary Swank, the actress who's nominated for an Academy Award for playing Brandon-Tina in the new movie Boys Don't Cry. Hilary, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Let's get back to that audition tape that so impressed director Kimberly Pierce. What did you do on that audition tape?
Well, you know, first of all, my agent sent me the script. I read it, and I didn't realize in the beginning that it was a true story. And I knew that I wanted to be a part of it because of the challenge it afforded me as an actor. And then I realized it was a true story. And then I wanted to be a part of it even more. It's a very important story, and I can relate to this story. So when I went into audition, I was just skimming the surface of what I wanted to do with Brandon. Obviously, you can't cut your hair off for an audition. So I tucked my hair, which was about mid-back, up into a cowboy hat that I bought at a secondhand store. I had strapped my breast, and I was wearing my husband's clothes. And as Kim said, I had a sock in my pants. And I actually signed in. I knew the casting directors, and they came down to get me, and they were looking around. You know, there were other actors in the room, and they just looked confused, and they finally pointed at me and said, are you ready? And I said, yes. Yeah. Well, no, I really said, yeah. And then we got in the elevator, and we were going up. And the casting director, Jennifer McNamara, looked down at her sign-in sheet and looked back at me, and about 30 seconds later said, Hillary? And I said, yep. And she said, wow, that's really great. And then I went in and I read, and we worked on it a little bit, and they said, you know, you're really capturing something here that I think Kim Pierce is going to relate to and like and respond to. They sent the tape to New York, where Kim had said she saw it with Christine Vachon, Eva Kolodner, the other producers. And I got a call about 4 days later saying, they saw the tape. They really responded to you. They really want to meet you. This is a movie that has no money. It's a very low budget. And if you want to meet with them, which they want to, you need to fly yourself to New York. So there was no qualms about that.
We're talking about Boys Don't Cry with Hilary Swank, who is nominated for an Academy Award for her portrayal of Tina Brandon, and Kimberly Pierce, who directed and co-wrote the film. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Hilary Swank, who's nominated for an Academy Award for her portrayal as Brandon Tina in the film Boys Don't Cry, and Kimberly Pierce, who directed the film and co-wrote it as well and dreamed up the idea for the film, too. So, Kimberly Pierce, you asked Hilary Swank to actually pass as a boy for a few weeks before actually making the movie. Mm-hmm. Did you get together and talk about what is it that makes a girl a girl and a boy, and what is it that a girl should pick up on to try to pass as a boy?
Yeah, it had been a thing I'd been thinking about for years because of myself, because of Brandon. I traveled with a group of 15 transsexuals back to the murder town in July of 94 and experienced False City with them, have been doing interviews with which lesbians and transsexuals for years. So it's a thing that I've always been thinking about and breaking down, and as a dramatist trying to figure out how you recreate that state for an audience. So when Hillary came to the scene, what I shared with her was all of Brandon's psychological history, all of this research with the transsexuals that I had been doing, and as much as I could, my own sense of what makes a girl, what makes a boy, and what that natural state in between is that I think that we all occupy to different degrees, and how she could move closer to the boy side. And, you know, instead of having her look at girls who passed as boys, I mostly had her look at my favorite, you know, heroes, kind of like, you know, James Dean and Jimmy Cagney and, you know, Cool Hand Luke, I don't know who else was in there, you know, Rebel was a big influence, and begin to figure out what made the Hollywood male, because that's really what Brandon was inspired by in a way.
So, Hillary, what are some of the things that you did with your body to try to look more masculine? What things that you did with your face, even your expressions?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, once I did get the offer after auditioning and they said, you know, the role is yours, I knew that if I couldn't pass as a boy, that I didn't want to do it because it would be doing the film a grave injustice, you know, being that this was someone's life, and I felt a huge responsibility to that. So it began with the physical transformation, the obvious, what Kim had talked about, cutting my hair off, when I looked in the mirror, I said, what is it about myself that looks masculine that I can enhance? And it was my bone structure, really. So I went on a workout binge, I guess you could say, for the whole 6 weeks before we started filming, where 45 minutes a day I'd do cardiovascular and an hour a day of weight training. Not necessarily to lose pounds, but to lose body fat. And that definitely started working for me. My face started really thinning out, which made my jaw bones protrude. I also was working on my voice, deepening my voice and the accent that I needed to use. I was working out a walk that I would have as Brandon. And a lot of these mannerisms that I got, that I was doing physically, were from just, as Kim said, observing men or boys. A lot of the things I did with my face were mannerisms my father has. All the pushing back of my hair and looking in the mirror is exactly an imitation of my father. I looked at pictures of Brandon Tina and saw how he liked to dress and what he liked to wear and how he passed, and I tried to emanate that. I think more importantly was the emotional transformation, because that's what shines through physically, I think. Just reading books on transgendered people, but actually going out on the street and trying to pass as a boy, seeing what works and what doesn't work. That was the biggest instrumental process for me, was just to see how people reacted to me.
Good. Well, let's stop there for a second. What didn't work? What did you think, oh, this will really seem masculine, and it didn't work?
Honestly, my butt. I have a very girl butt, but you know, well, that was one of the things. It was funny, every time I walk away on camera, they would have to, you know, cut early before my butt got too much into the shot. But you know, what was interesting about that is there, you know, there were probably things about Brandon that he had to mask that you know, looked girly.
Wait, but how did you know your butt wasn't working? Did somebody say, oh, you're not,
no,
you're not, well, a man, you've got a female's behind?
No. You know, that was the thing, though, is I wasn't going out when I was passing on the street and saying, hey, I'm an actress, do you think I look like a boy? You know, I was really living my life as a boy. I'm talking 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. My husband went along with me and introduced me as Hillary's brother. My neighbors thought that I was Hillary's brother. I passed on my neighbors. I passed on acquaintances. I passed on people that I'd worked with before. And about, you know, a half hour into conversations with these people, I would say, it's me, Hillary.
Did they share with you what they found convincing and unconvincing about you as a boy?
I would ask them, and they had said, well, obviously you just had a conversation with me for about a half an hour and I didn't know. So I don't really see anything.
I also think what I noticed was, with the voice trainer and the physical trainer, as her voice lowered and as she just became more defined as a boy physically, it became easier and easier to suspend disbelief. And then as she approached the character more and more, as he had more of a soul and a complete identity, I think that the identity started taking over. And then what was amazing was that Hillary could smile, because so many of the other girls either didn't smile and then you wouldn't be invited in, or if they did smile, they seemed like girls. But she managed to find a male smile. And that was just extraordinary. So I think that, you know what I mean? I feel like as you were moving towards playing the role and living that life as you were, it was like you were beginning to understand how to use that language of boyness.
Yeah.
Could we describe what a male smile is?
Well, I would have to say I think that my smile as a girl is a very wide, open-tooth grin. And as Brandon, I didn't really show my teeth. I kept my lips kind of pursed together, and I don't know, it's kind of hard to show on the air. I'm used to showing my face and showing what, I don't know how to describe it actually in words, but it was more of a smaller kind of half smile, you know, with your chin kind of lowered down, and you know, it's a smile with your eyes.
I'm looking now, it's a form of control in a way. That maybe, yeah, a girl reveals a certain vulnerability that a male might not, because as I'm looking at Hillary now and she's smiling as Brandon, it's...
And you smile with a different confidence. I think as a girl, you kind of smile more coyly and you kind of put your head down and, you know, you have a little giggle come out. And I think as Brandon, it was more of a, you know, silence and a nod of the head and a smile in the eye and looking straight in the eye. And so.
At the beginning of the movie, Brandon Tina has just started passing as male. And he's talking to, I think it's his cousin. And his cousin says to him, why don't you just admit you're a dyke? And Brandon Tina says, because I'm not a dyke. In an article I was reading from the Village Voice, Brandon Tina had said that he was really uncomfortable with lesbians, that he didn't like the idea of lesbians. And I'm wondering if either of you felt that Brandon Tina was a lesbian or whether he was really transgendered. Because he didn't have the language for any of this anyways. He had no background in gender studies or gender analysis or the gay rights movement or the transgendered rights movement.
You know, one of the biggest dramatic questions in the story is, how are you going to tell the story of a kid who makes this choice to go to Falls City and not to go to San Francisco or New York and play out a queer life and he would have lived? So everybody was like, well, why did he go down to Falls City? And you needed to figure that out to make the script work. So two important things. One, when Brandon was 14 years old, he told his mom he was a lesbian and she put him into an institution. From that point forward, the idea of being a lesbian in his mind was bad. There was no language for that. So he probably suppressed his desire. He probably still was attracted to girls, probably looked in the mirror and thought, wow, I look like a guy. Simple solution to a complicated problem. If I make myself into a straight guy, then I'm normal. Then I can live the life that everybody normal around me lives and I can have a family. Well, I can't do that here in Lincoln because everybody knows who I am and I keep getting in trouble and I've been asking all these girls out and, you know, stealing all their credit cards, so I have to get out of town. Well, where's he going to go? Well, not New York or San Francisco and become queer, if you want to call that lesbian or transsexual, because those are, in his mind, the people who are not normal. So then he goes down to Falls City, and what he does is he reappropriates what everybody wants, the American dream. Get the girl, you know, be the guy, be normal. And so what's important about that is when you say, was Brandon a lesbian or a transsexual? I interviewed lesbians, I interviewed transsexuals. As I came to understand this character more deeply, I thought, well, the last thing you want to do is categorize him or anybody else. Desire. That's the one true thing about all of us. We all have desire, and we have desire to dress ourselves up in a certain identity that helps reflect the identity we feel on the inside. We have a desire to sleep with other people. Sometimes it's the opposite sex, sometimes it's the same sex. What I felt was, as a dramatist, I needed to tap into Brandon's core, what his life need was, and that was love and acceptance. And if you followed that, it made sense of every choice all the way out.
Kimberly Pierce directed and co-wrote Boys Don't Cry. Hilary Swank is the film's star. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Princeton University Press, publishers of The Eternal Darkness, a personal history of deep sea exploration by the oceanographer Robert Ballard. In bookstores or online at www.pup.princeton.edu. From Garden.com, an online source for gardening advice and home delivery of over 14,000 plants, tools, and gardening products. And from Random House and its division, The Dial Press, publisher of In Our Time, Memoir of a Revolution by Susan Brown Miller, a history of the feminist movement. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Yes, I tell you, baby, I don't mean maybe. Don't you understand? Your mother keeps stalling. Don't you start falling. I'm gonna be your man.
Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the New Orleans band Huey Smith and the Clowns. And we continue our conversation with film director Kimberly Pierce and actress Hilary Swank of the film Boys Don't Cry.
Yes, I love you, baby. Yes, you know it's the only one who's crazy. Me, if I don't love you, you. We've been together through all kinds of weather. You better understand. We get 16 chilling, cause I'm willing to be your man.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Hilary Swank, who's nominated for an Oscar for her starring role in Boys Don't Cry, and Kimberly Pierce, who conceived, co-wrote, and directed the film. Boys Don't Cry is based on the true story of Tina Brandon, a young woman who passed as a man and was raped and murdered by two buddies after they discovered that Brandon was really a girl. Kimberly Pierce, I know you interviewed a lot of the people who knew Brandon Tina when Brandon Tina was passing as a boy. And one of the people you interviewed was Lana Tisdale, and she's the person who's portrayed by Chloe Sevigny in the movie. And this is the woman who was Brandon Tina's true love. In the movie, when Brandon Tina is forced to reveal that he's really a girl, Lana says that she loves him anyways, and it doesn't matter what he is or what she is. And they end up making love together as two women. And I'm wondering if there's any real-life precedent for that, if Lana, the real Lana, reacted that way, and if the real Lana was willing to make love with Tina Brandon, you know, with Brandon after he was revealed to be a girl.
As I envisioned it, it never was that Brandon Tina became a girl after the stripping of his male identity. The movie starts out, there's Tina who feels that she is a boy, and she invents herself into Brandon, many other identities. The rape destroys that identity, and so she can't be Tina or Brandon, but she's this deeper, truer sense of him herself. So when Lana and Brandon get back together in that scene, what we have is a reversal. So Brandon has spent his entire life covering his identity and giving women pleasure, and he himself has never been able to receive pleasure because he's been so threatened by it. So in that moment, what you really have is Brandon receiving love, and I think that intimacy is the most threatening thing that most of us face. I think we're terrified by it. So that scene is much more about the acceptance of love. And in terms of it being true to life, absolutely. The movie fundamentally came out of my interview with Lana. When I went to Fall City, I found her, went to her house. Actually, she thought I was Brandon for a moment. And we engaged in this conversation. And the most important question was, so when did you know that Brandon was a girl? And she said to me, oh, I knew Brandon was a girl the day that I met him when I sang karaoke. And I was like, to myself, oh my God, there's no movie. And then I said, so you really knew that Brandon was a girl when you sang karaoke? And she was like, well, no, I didn't really know that he was a girl until he told me so in the jail, which is that scene that you're referring to. I don't care if you're half monkey, half ape, I'm getting you out of here. And I said, so that's when you knew? And she's like, well, no, I didn't really know until they stripped him. So if you look at the way it's handled in the movie, actually, Brandon is trying to come clean in that scene and say, I really am not who you think I am. And if you notice the way we've edited it, Lana shuts him up. Lana doesn't want to have it confirmed that he's a girl publicly, so she's burying it into her unconscious. So it's still not clear then, just as it wasn't clear when Lana said to me in real life. And then I said, so you knew during, you know, the rape and the stripping. And then I said, so finally when you were going to run away with Brandon, it must have been he was a girl at that point, so you guys were going to run away as lovers or friends. And she said, oh, well, because he was a girl, you know, as friends. The running away to Lincoln. So I said, okay, so if Brandon had actually gotten the sex change operation after you guys ran away and you had made it to Lincoln, could you guys then have been lovers? And she said, well, no, Brandon didn't need to get a sex change operation. He was always a man to me. So what you begin to detect in the real life person is an unwillingness to categorize Brandon as a boy or a girl, then or now. And what you sense is an absolute beautiful love affair where these two people connected as souls and where the society was saying, well, is he a girl? Is he a boy? And by forcing her into a category that she kept slipping out of, there really was no moment of saying, well, Brandon was a girl or Brandon was a boy. And that was what we fought so hard to capture in the writing, the casting, and the directing, in which I think Hillary and Chloe get, which is so beautiful, is I think that they bring the audience inside that real soul love.
Well, it sounds like the real Lana was being very inconsistent, either because she was confused about when she knew the truth or because she required a certain amount of self-deception to carry on.
One, it could be both of those, and then the other way of looking at it is because maybe she was able to bypass all that. You know, maybe on a strange level, she had a kind of what we would call a poetic ability to entertain things that seem like contradictions but really aren't. Mm-hmm. That line in the movie when Brandon says, what are you going to tell them? And she says, I'm going to tell them what they want to hear. I'm going to tell them what we know is true. That's verbatim from the real Lana. Now think about that. I'm going to tell them what they want to hear. I'm going to tell them what we know is true. What the hell is that? It's not really anything, and yet it's everything. You know, I mean, she's kind of like a little Rimbaud, I always thought.
Kimberly, I want to ask you about the rape scene. There's two scenes that I imagine were very difficult to choreograph, the rape scene and the murder scene. In the rape scene, the two guys who had, you know, befriended Brandon Tina find out that he's really a girl, and they're kind of angry and really threatened by it, and they rape her very brutally, and later kill her, and kill a couple of other people as well. So those two scenes, the rape scene and the murder scene, I had to be choreographed in the way that the rest of the film wasn't. And I imagine this was your first time having to choreograph that kind of brutality. And I would just like you to talk a little bit about what you did to stage it, what kind of talks you had with the actors, how you mentally went through it in your mind before doing it on film.
Sure. The one thing that I always start out with is a psychological map, in a way. And I think about the scene in terms of what do I need to achieve. That there's a vulnerability here, that they're raping Brandon because they desire Brandon, they fear him, they feel betrayed by him. And really what they're doing is they're forcing Brandon from being a boy back into being a girl. So it's like I know kind of the psychological movement of it. Then I come in with the actors and I give them they have their life need throughout the film, and then they have their scene need. And you try to break it down as clearly emotionally beat by beat as you can, because that means then that they're not going to be acting, they're going to be doing. And hopefully then you reveal the most meaning. We were fortunate in that we were able to rehearse with the car. The car became the metaphor of the scene in a way, because you know, think about the American like teenage life. Think of most of our lives. We probably had our first kiss, had sex for the first time, might have gotten raped in a car. I think it's such an American emblem. So having that car really became a center point of how we organized the rape scene. In terms of the camera stuff, I mean, that was the one time that we were on a dolly. If you notice, when we shot the stripping scene, we were completely planted, and it was very static. When we're on the rape, we're moving, because I knew that there was so much physical stuff to cover that we didn't want the audience to get stuck in a shot, whereas in the murder scene, we're actually handheld in certain positions. In terms of working with the actors, I was most concerned for Hillary, because I didn't want to brutalize her, or I didn't want to brutalize Brandon's memory. It was important to me that in the rape scene, we were always moving forward with the story, that everything was about deepening the audience's involvement and never showing any gratuitous violence, and yet we had to go to real extremes. But in terms of the guys, they ended up being more vulnerable than Hillary, I thought. They were terrified of carrying out this rape because it was like such a reflection of what men are capable of. And if anything, I mean, Hillary should talk about her experience, but what ended up happening was Brandon Sexton, after two takes, wasn't getting the intensity of the rape, and I actually had to push him to reach for the fear and the betrayal and the desire that he unleashed on Brandon. And that was a scary moment as a woman, forcing this man to go farther. But he reached deep inside of himself, and he exploded in that take, and that's the one we use. And he immediately left set, and I had to track him down, and he was crying. And he turned his face away from me, and I said, "What's wrong?" And he said, "I don't want you to look at me. I'm crying. I'm sorry." And I said, no. The fact that you're crying is good. That means you're not like these guys. If these guys would have cried, they might not have destroyed Brandon. Hence, boys don't cry. And so it was important to me to be able to entertain as much of the intensity without ever violating my actors or my characters. And it was a transcendent scene for all of us. I mean, I just, you know, I feel like we got what it was that we were seeking that we didn't know when we set out to do it.
Let me just mention something else. Peter Skarsgård, who plays the murderer, the person who's really the ringleader, he played a victim in Dead Man Walking. He was the person who watches his girlfriend get raped and then he gets killed. So he's kind of been through the other end of that on screen, so it must have been difficult for him to become the killer and rapist this time around.
Well, difficult, and also I think what's scary for these guys was it was tapping into something that was potential for them. Not that these guys are rapists. My guys are so warm and vulnerable, but if anything, it's tapping into a potential that men have simply because of who they are physically. And the other, you know, important thing in that scene is to keep John and Tom very separate. John is, you know, terrified of the rape, and Tom is really driving it. He's kind of like the second lieutenant who's finding power and control, you know, a homoerotic, you know, the rape of Brandon. So it was keeping those dynamics alive, and you know, and then all the stunt work. I mean, again, it's like those hits have to feel real. So sometimes you're doing eight takes to make sure that a punch connects, because that's part of the visceral matter for the audience. And then the recutting it so that it was all through Brandon's perspective, that it's all a journey of his identity.
Hilary Swank, tell us about the scene from your perspective.
Well, you know, it was definitely a safe environment. Everyone was fully aware of what we were doing, and the scene was almost choreographed. It was choreographed to make sure that everyone felt safe. We all knew that at any moment we could say, stop, 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 cut, cut, cut. I can't go any further. And I think the actors were all aware of each other's boundaries and really respected each other. The hardest thing for me was, and it still makes me feel emotional because to think I was doing that scene and that it wasn't real and that I had someone respecting my boundaries, yet this happened to somebody and they weren't respecting each other's boundaries. And it was, to think that that happened to someone is very hard. And that was the only thing that almost got it so that I couldn't make it through the scene. I was very emotional and I really had to hold back, not just going and falling apart. My heart goes out to victims that this happens to. I can't imagine what that must be like.
Did you find yourself wondering to what extent Brandon Tino was able to maintain that kind of self-confidence and swagger and likability that made him so convincing, made him so likable, able to maintain any of that during this scene of total violation? Do you know what I mean? How much he was able, or she was able to draw on that well, and how much?
Well, I think
she
what
just
happens.
Totally collapsed.
I think there's a lot of things that you go through when something like this happens. I don't know if you remember the scene afterwards where Brandon's hitting himself in the head, and looking at himself in the mirror and pulling on his hair. I think that he was thinking, "I did this to myself. I caused all of this. I am the reason why this happened." And I think that that's what happens in these situations. We blame ourselves.
I thought in that scene he was also thinking, what do I think of my body now? What is my body? Who am I?
I think
do
it's
I
everything.
Like this body?
Yes, I think it's all of that mixed together. I think it's what has just happened. There's a shock. You know, I think Brandon was in shock. I think Brandon was forced back into his feminine body. I think, and just as I said before, I cause all of this. I am the reason why I'm hurting right now.
And it's also the first moment that what I think is important is in the self-blame and the awareness of self-blame, particularly with rape stuff or any kind of trauma, then is the next step towards fighting back. Because that's the first time that he ever then lies to John. Because after looking at himself in the mirror and saying, I brought this on myself, they did this to me, then he says, oh yeah, I'll be right out. And then it's all about the escape. So it's a sense of empowerment comes from the admission of the destruction to oneself.
Right. There's different steps I think you go through when you're suffering.
And then he runs.
And then he runs. And he says, okay, now
I'm going to take care of myself.
I'm going to leave.
Yeah, I'm going to leave
and then I'm going to live.
Yeah.
He runs rather than remaining hostage.
Yeah, this is it. I'm going to save myself as opposed to, he used to think saving himself was recreating the family and getting everybody's love. Now he's just like, I'm going to save myself and they're no longer me. There was a detachment from that world.
My guests are Kimberly Pierce, who directed and co-wrote Boys Don't Cry, and Hilary Swank, who's nominated for an Oscar for her portrayal of Tina Brandon. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Hilary Swank, who's nominated for an Academy Award for her role as Brandon Tina in Boys Don't Cry, and Kimberly Pierce, who co-wrote and directed the film. I'm wondering if on the set you, Hilary, stayed in character as a male.
I did. In fact, in the beginning, that was something that I had intentionally planned on doing. And as we started filming, we were working 6-day weeks, 18-hour days, never less than 14 hours, sometimes 22 hours. So inevitably, I was actually forced to live this. It became something that was forced and not just planned anymore. But therefore, what ended up happening to me was I was living a complete and different identity. I was masking all my own mannerisms and never having a minute to be Hillary. So therefore, I felt like halfway through filming, we had a few weeks left, that I had lost myself completely. And it was actually scary. I felt like I was never going to find Hillary again. I was kind of, not kind of, I was floating between genders. I was not completely girl and I was not completely boy. So that was interesting for me.
And it was also a thing that most of the people that I interviewed, the transsexuals, went through in their transition. And so it ended up being a really important part of Hillary tapping into the character. And I think to her testament, you know, what she had down was the charm and the humor and this, you know, inept criminal, the confidence. But the fact that she also was able to show the vulnerability and allow herself to go to a place that was terrifying, I think, is what really rounded out the character.
Kimberly, did you want Hillary to stay in character on the set?
I did, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, she met the actors as a boy. I wanted her to be Brandon all the time.
Why? And actually, why?
Well, and this is interesting because she taught me something. She told me, I wanted her to be Brandon all the time because Brandon had to be Brandon most of the time, pretty much all the time with these people. And I wanted to reapproximate Brandon's life as much as possible on every single emotional level so that the audience was really seeing a true experience. They weren't just seeing an act. And because he didn't have the privilege of going home and being a girl or getting comforted. Now, I told Hillary, she said, oh, my husband's going to come out. And I was like, oh, I don't think I want your husband to come out because it's going to take you out of character. And she insisted. She's like, no, Kim, he needs to come out a little bit at a time because that's where my security lies as a person. And I was really like, well, I don't think that that's right. And I remember sleeping on it, and then I woke up and I realized that she was right, which was, even though I wanted her to completely be Brandon, we were making a movie, and part of her strength lie in the fact that she has a kind of comfort that Brandon didn't have. So that was like a lesson that I learned.
And that was definitely what was going to make me do the best job that I could, was having the things around me that made me comfortable.
And allowed you to reach the vulnerable and the terrifying moments and sit with that. I think that her bravery was that she sat with the unknown. And the unknown is what's so terrifying to all of us.
Having my husband with me, as she was just touching on, did give me the security to go where I needed to go because he knows me better than anyone. I've been with him for 7.5 years. And it gave me that safety net to really dive in fully. And he was there knowing me and knowing me deeper than anyone. So he could say, I could go back to him and feel safe. That's really what that did for me.
And then come back to Brandon. I mean, I was afraid we'd lose Brandon, but if anything, Brandon existed. Once we created him, we'd get to set every day, and bam, he was there.
Hillary, a question for you. Mm-hmm. After having made this movie and passed as a boy in the film, did you take away anything about your own identity? Was there anything that subtly changed about your identity, the way you walk, the way you talk, the way you smile,
you know,
the way you think of yourself?
Yes. As I was saying before, I've learned a lot about myself. And it's not an outward appearance thing. I didn't change the way I walked or I didn't change the way I look. I've changed on the inside and I've grown a whole lot. I've realized Brandon has been a huge inspiration to me, and in that he was someone who lived his life the way he wanted to. He had the courage to be himself. And I think in life, that's what life's about, is honoring yourself and following your dreams and following your heart and each day waking up and saying, what is my meaning? How can I go out and be me today? And that's what this experience has given me, and it's such a great gift, and it's one that I am very thankful for.
Well, I want to thank you both so much, and congratulations on the success of the film.
Thank you very much for having us.
Kimberly Pierce directed and co-wrote Boys Don't Cry. Hilary Swank is nominated for an Oscar for her portrayal of Tina Brandon. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the New Orleans band Huey Smith and the Clowns. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Spouting gibberish and featuring a cross-dressing lead singer, Huey Piano Smith and the Clowns weren't your average rock and roll band, or even your average New Orleans rock and roll band. They had a number of hits and even inspired Mac, Dr. John Rebinac, to take up the piano. Rock historian Ed Ward has their story.
First rock and roll records I ever got was a four-track EP that Dick Clark gave away if you sent in some gum wrappers, and it was, I think, responsible for my parents deciding I'd flipped out. You see, one of the tracks on it, which I played over and over, was Don't You Just Know It by Huey Piano Smith and the Clowns. I kept playing it because I couldn't figure out the words, other than, of course, gooba 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 gooba. What I didn't know at the time was that I'd gotten a unique view into New Orleans rock and roll history, as exemplified by Huey Piano Smith, whose piano style echoed nearly all of the city's masters of that instrument to date. Smith was born in 1934 and, inspired by an uncle, took piano lessons at a music school and watched the local hero, Professor Longhair, every chance he could get. In 1950, he teamed up with a Mississippi guitar player, Eddie Jones, who was known as Guitar Slim, and wound up leading his band, although it was Ray Charles who played piano on Slim's hit, The Things I Used to Do. Slim acquired a manager who fired Huey, so he joined Earl King's band for a few years and did a lot of sessions. In 1955, he came to the attention of Johnny Vincent, who ran the Ace label out of Mississippi, and was one of the first to realize that New Orleans was a hotbed of what was becoming known as rock and roll. Rocking up the nursery rhyme song Little Liza Jane, Huey's first record for Vincent was a local hit, so he was inspired to write a song himself. Taking his cue from a line in Chuck Berry's Roll Over Beethoven about catching the rockin' pneumonia at a rhythm review, he wound up with his first national hit. Pneumonia and the Boogie Woogie Flu was a top 10 R&B hit in 1957, but Smith didn't have a band to take on the road to promote it. And anyway, he'd already contracted to tour with Shirley and Lee, who were riding high with Let the Good Times Roll. One night they played Baltimore, and their opening act was another New Orleans singer, Bobby Marchand, whose current record, Chicky Wawa, Smith had played on.
When you told me that you loved me, did you mean a word? When you told me that you loved me, everybody heard. Now that we're alone, just me and you, tell me, Chicky, why, what you gonna do? Sitting in the movie.
Realizing that it was silly of them both to have hits and no band, they decided that night to start one, which Marchand named The Clowns. Their first record stiffed, but the second was Don't You Just Know It, which had another hit on the B-side.
I get a high.
Marchand was a more versatile singer than Smith, and the record was a national top 10 pop hit. As a trivia note, Don't You Just Know It was a catchphrase the band's driver and valet, the future X-rated comedian Rudy Ray Moore, used to say. Their next hit was based on a Mardi Gras Indians tune. But Don't You Know Yakumo was too similar to the previous record to really make an impact. Furthermore, in 1958, Marchand left the band. But Johnny Vincent realized he had a winner with the Clowns, and so he used them on the first record by a teen idol he was promoting.
Old man rhythm is in my shoes. It's no use to sitting and singing the blues. So be my guest, you got nothing to lose. Won't you let me take you on a sea cruise? Hoo-wee! Hoo-wee, baby, hoo-wee, hoo-wee, baby, hoo-wee, hoo-wee, baby, won't you let me take you on a sea cruise?
The bland-looking Frankie Ford became a wild man with the Clowns behind him. By 1960, though, Smith's style was going out of fashion. He kept recording as a band leader and sideman for some years, and eventually got religion and retired.
On Saturday night, when I go for my date, my baby and I just sit and wait for
Argus, the Magnificent.
Our rock historian Ed Ward currently lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Brendan Noonan. I'm Terry Gross.
Argus, Magnificent.
We don't go out to roll and rock. We get our kicks from the house and shop. If you want a thrill, turn the lights down low. Set for the groove, steal the show, see.
Argus, the Magnificent.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Princeton University Press, publishers of The Eternal Darkness, a personal history of deep sea exploration by the oceanographer Robert Ballard. In bookstores or online at www.pup.princeton.edu. From Garden.com, an online source for gardening advice and home delivery of over 14,000 plants, tools, and gardening products. And from Random House and its Bantam Books division, publisher of Bones of the Master, A Buddhist Monk's Search for the Lost Heart of China by George Crane. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we put our questions about nutrition and fad diets to Dr. Andrew Weil, author of the new book Eating Well for Optimum Health. Weil is one of the pioneers of holistic medicine. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.